While this week of news has been dominated by conservative firebrand Milo Yiannopoulos' unearthed comments about pedophilia from an appearance on the podcast The Joe Rogan Experience, Milo is far from the only conservative who has made compromising comments on the MMA and DMT enthusiasts' popular show. Today, the Chapo News Network investigative team has uncovered a trove of controversial clips from members of the Trump cabinet who have also gone on the Joe Rogan Experience. One is Defense Secretary James Mattis, seen here in a July 2015 appearance.
So that's when I realized if I make the rules of engagement broader, my men can kill every single thing that moves. You know, Joe, I got into the military because I wanted to top me lie, and I'm proud to say I did, several times over.
Bro, that is a fucking war crime. That's like shit you go to the fucking Hague for. That is so fucked. But, I mean, yeah, back to what you were originally saying, I won't ever fucking forget the first time that I heard Stevie Ray Vaughan play guitar while I was high. His fingers knew exactly where to go on the guitar before his brain did.
Right.
That's some powerful shit. Like, when you get high enough, James Mattis, you can see exactly how a great musician figures out a song before their, like, conscious mind even knows how to. It's like they're connecting with this higher power.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions didn't do himself any favors during his episode, which was recorded in September of 2016.
Well, I do declare that if a man should be in that there Google Chrome and he opens a window in the incognito, anything he looks at is not illegal. Now, look, Joseph, I may be a simple country lawyer and senator, but I swear on the memory of General Lee that you cannot be convicted of downloading pornographic images and video of the child persuasion. If you mosey on down in that incognito window.
That makes no fucking sense, dude. You're still, like, fucking literally looking at child porn. That's fucked. Have you ever seen a video of two gorillas, like, play fighting and shit? It's like, they fucking know jiu-jitsu. It's fucking amazing. Like, the gorillas do half guard and butterfly sweeps and shit. You have to fucking see it. But yeah, no, what you were saying was fucked up.
Embattled Education Secretary Betsy DeVos may have come off the worst.
You know, the biggest reason we think charter schools are so important is because of opportunity, and the opportunity these disadvantaged children get to be a part of something bigger. In some of the selected schools we operate, we select one child every year who will be sacrificed to the Yellow King. Now, what that's going to do is widen the portal to the Dark Obelisk and grant us immeasurable powers. So if enough children are given to him, we can even become immortal. Teachers' unions, on the other hand, you know, they're not going to allow kids that we teach to reach out to a power so great.
Are you fucking... Betsy, I fucking respect you and shit, but that is not right. You can't sacrifice a fucking child, whether the Yellow fucking King or whatever is real or not. Kids should be, like, smoking weed and making out with each other under bleachers and shit. Playing outside. Betsy, have you ever gotten really fucked up and called your grandmother? You know, like, I did this last month. I was, like, just fucking weeping by the end of the call. Not because I was sad or anything, but it was just so much emotion. I mean... People definitely abuse alcohol, but it comes from nature and has this natural purpose. It's in the Bible and shit like that. It's not like fucking Xanax or any of this evil shit that we make in laboratories. It's from the earth, and there's like a purpose to it. You know, I think that people should do that more. They should get really fucked up and call their grandmother.
Well, no one can accuse me of not enjoying a glass of wine, but my grandmother unfortunately passed in a temple ritual some years ago.
Ah, fuck, I'm sorry.
Hello, friends. It's your midweek Chapo. We're back again. The gang is here. And just to kick it off, we are talking this week with Tsuja Hader of Viewpoint Magazine, contributor.
Tsuja, what's up, Grey Wolf?
What's going on?
How you doing?
Not bad. Also joining us is Virgil.
Hey, everyone.
Amber.
Hi.
And Matt.
Hey, folks.
Oh, shit, Matt. I did not realize you were there.
You've
been in that
present.
Little box the whole time?
Yeah, I'm basically like Kit on Knight Rider.
You don't have to yell, Shuja. Matt is all around you.
I can feel his presence now. You're right.
We've got a few things to talk to you about this week, but just to kick things off, Amber, you and Shuja were on a panel together this week, and I think that may be a good place to begin.
We were on a panel. I moderated, which is the best person to be on a panel because you get to pretend to be smart but not have to prepare to say anything. But Shuja did a wonderful job.
Well, thank you.
And it was on privilege and cultural appropriation. And we very cleverly stacked it with a dissident feminist and POC.
You know, this is one thing I always tell people, that like I volunteer to be a token. Like, yeah, if you need a token to make the right argument, I'm your man.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you got to tag in somebody. But it went extremely well. We were both, I think, prepared for maybe some hostility from the crowd.
This is things that Amber and I talked about beforehand. We were convinced that some college student was going to get really mad and get up and yell at us.
Yeah, we were very like, I got your back. Like, if someone calls you like a cishet bro, I'll
now,
I will
now,
go
where was the panel, though?
It was at Mayday Space in Bushwick, which is very cool and connected to a church, which is weird because sometimes you accidentally walk into a chapel.
I almost did, yeah.
Yeah. But it was packed, and it did really well. Also, beforehand, someone, this very nice young guy, an Asian American guy, came up to me and said, Amber, I just want to say I'm a really big fan of Chapo, and I like your writing, but I kind of wanted to know, can I still be a good socialist and listen to Cumtown? And I was like,
well, what
bless
did you,
child.
You were going to say?
Bless
you're
you, child.
You're on fucking Cumtown. He basically wanted a backdoor way to brag that he's edgy enough to listen to Cumtown.
Oh.
He wanted to say the word cum to a woman.
Not all of us
he
have done that.
He was a very nice young man. They were all very cool kids. And also, you had to leave early because your band had a show. But
my band had a show that night, and it was the weirdest show I've ever played because we were basically almost like playing behind the bar. There was no room for us.
You missed the dance party situation. And you missed all the cultural appropriation.
Was there a lot of that going
there
on at the dance
so
party?
So much cultural appropriation.
Well, they played, yeah. They kicked it off with Migos, Bad and Bougie, which I think is good because that song is class conscious.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Also, it did the thing where, I mean, I remember
did somebody drop the Rich Chiga track that RL incorporated into his
RL
talk.
Didn't even make the request, I don't think. He should have.
So we were on a panel with RL Stevens, who's an organizer in Chicago, and as his example of why he loves cultural appropriation, he brought up the track by Rich Chiga called That Stick.
It's a fucking great song.
It's an awesome song. Apparently it's by this Indonesian teenager who learned English from rap music, so like I think he doesn't know English other than the way like Dirty South rappers talk, and it is the dopest track.
He is the Elvis of South Asia.
Just put it on the end of this episode.
There's a great video, too, of like rappers reacting to it. And because in the video, he's wearing like a polo shirt that's buttoned all the way up to the top and a fanny pack. And they're all like, what the fuck is this? And then as soon as he starts rapping, they're like, this is the dopest motherfucker I've ever seen. Including Ghostface Killa, who is just mesmerized.
Yeah, but...
Listen to Tone Loc?
Tone Loc,
he's
yes.
Pretty fresh.
Yes, that is.
Before we get into the specifics of the panel, Felix and I did show up, of course, to the party after all of this, because this is my understanding of socialism is that just other people do work and then you come up, you show up later and take things from them. And I got to see just a lot of, like, again, really excited, earnest, bright-eyed young people approach Felix and try to engage him seriously. But, like, because they listen to the show and they think, like, oh, you know, this is great. It's Felix Biederman, but they don't actually know him like I do. So I got to sit there and watch these kids try to talk to Felix and just see his brain glaze over and just start talking about his TV or Steven Seagal.
Okay.
Not good on your toes, buddy.
No, I'm actually great on my toes because I've never prepared for anything and I've succeeded to this point. But... in my defense, we had watched the Steven Seagal movie, The Mercenary Absolution, before. And, Will, this is also your fault, because on the entire ride over, we were just talking to each other. Me, you, and Brendan were talking to each other like Seagal. Like, every time we were like, you know, oh, is this in Bushwick? We would say it like, so we'd be like, if a motherfucker in YDS has done some bad shit in his life, he silenced women and POCs. But I'm deciding to go on it. And so, yeah, no, like, it's all I talk about.
And you've been doing that for a half hour beforehand,
like,
correct?
Like, 90 minutes.
Folks, if you run into Felix or me at a conference and you want to talk to us, you better have some knowledge about elevators right there.
People are just, like, Will, oh, my God, I'm a huge fan of the show. Like, it just, you're the reason I'm here today. And I'm like, what's your name, son? And they go, oh, Will, my name is Will, too. I don't like that. Change yourself for me. I'm sorry, we're getting way too off track with our moronic anecdotes, but yeah.
The dance party was actually really great, because I remember being at YDS parties like years ago when there weren't a ton of people there, and there would usually be like one guy with an iPod playing like Against Me, and like me and like three other girls and two gay guys going, play something girls like. And I didn't even like Top 40 Radio, but it's a dance party. You put on dance music. But it was shout out to Chris Maizano, who DJed. Did an amazing job.
Did he?
And
so it was all Steely Dan, I would imagine.
It was a lot of yacht rock.
Okay.
No, but it was like, but you saw sort of like people coming forward for their various representative music types. Like, like when Beyonce would come on, you would hear a shriek of women. And like when there was like 90s Madonna, there was a distinctly gay yop. And on the sidelines the whole time, there were all these, let's say, heterosexual looking, because you never want to guess, but white guys. And they would sort of like, they were getting sort of drunk and they were kind of nodding along. And then after, I think, some like 90s Jay-Z song, Chris had the inspired... he made the inspired decision to put on The Cure's Friday I'm in Love.
Oh, wow.
And there was
this wave of
white men suddenly like running to the floor and start dancing. And it was actually very beautiful. It was like, have you ever seen like a 19-year-old undergrad at UPenn studying Poli Sci find his heart song on the dance floor? It was very beautiful. And then they stuck around for all of it. And
but I mean, you bring up the example of the dance party and all the various sort of genres of music and the varied reactions to it. And like, music is a good I don't know.
It's like the perfect example.
It's the perfect example of what you were talking about, when, you know, and like how cultural appropriation works or doesn't work, and what it is and isn't. And I guess, like, I want to ask, like,
although I did have to dance salsa that night, and I think I would have gotten away with it had there not been kids from El Paso there that could actually dance. So that's why you shouldn't do cultural appropriation, because you will look stupid.
Right, but music is the primary vector through which, like, culture is quote-unquote appropriated.
Yeah,
but, like,
yeah.
But like, before we get there, like, Suja, you've written about this, and, like, what do you think is, like, a good working definition of, like, cultural appropriation? Like, how is it used now versus how was it used originally? Like, what is the sort of history of this idea?
Well, the way it's used now typically will argue that it's a theft of a kind, that it's like somebody from a privileged group, which is a loaded term in itself, who takes a kind of cultural practice from a minority group or a marginalized group and exploits it. But that's a really kind of inversion of the way the term was used when we first started to hear it, which was from like Marxist cultural studies in the 60s, who for the first time kind of identified subcultures within cultures. So like youth cultures in music, punks, and so on, ethnic cultures within bigger cultures, they were forming their own cultures through that same process of cultural appropriation by taking things and using them in ways that they weren't intended to be used and forming their own communities.
Sort of like sampling.
Sort of like sampling. Yeah. That's a great example. You know, like if you're like De La Soul sampling Hall & Oates, you know, that's a transformation of where it was coming from.
But like, okay, so like in the current you know, it's in the parlance of our times, cultural appropriation. Like you said, it's usually an accusation of theft by which like a dominant culture steals something from an oppressed culture and like makes it their own or makes money off of it in some way. I mean, like I think that's kind of dumb, but like, is there a kernel of truth, or is there a way this argument can be intelligently presented?
There's, I think what's happening is that people are looking at a situation and they're looking at something off to the side and missing what's really happening. You know, it's a kind of a distraction. The example I gave on the panel was Elvis, who's like the classic person who's cited as a cultural appropriator in music. And the argument often goes something like, well, it wasn't right for Elvis to become very successful playing rock and roll when black musicians like Chuck Berry couldn't get into segregated clubs in the South. And if you say that like there was something wrong with Elvis playing rock and roll, you're missing the fact that there was a segregated society that was keeping Chuck Berry out of clubs in the South. You know, if you're focused on Elvis, you're missing George Wallace. You know, if you're focused on limiting the rights and capabilities of, you know, the archetypal white male, you're not winning more rights for women and people of color and other marginalized groups.
And one of the things you brought up, too, and I think we all kind of agreed on the panel, is that, like, people who object to cultural appropriation, I mean, that's an inherently conservative objection. You don't want mixing.
It is, yeah.
And originally, who was mad about Elvis playing black music? It was white racists.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it what it does is it kind of accepts as an assumption the idea of discrete racial groups that are separate categories of people that have their own practices that should be limited to those groups, which is, you know, the favorite idea of people on the alt-right.
Yeah.
And, you know, is totally not based in science. You know, it's something that we should be aggressively rejecting.
I think that's an interesting point and one worth exploring further. When you say it's not based in science, which they 100% believe it is, like, could you explain more about that? Like, how so?
Yeah, I mean, so the idea of race, the sociologist Paul Gilroy has a phrase I like. He calls it a spurious biological theory. It's a biological hypothesis that's saying that these collections of phenotypical traits are evidence of subspecies of humans.
Right.
And that's simply not true. The traits are really widely randomly distributed.
Shuja, are you denying the one true science of phrenology?
What about haplogroups?
What did Matt say?
I don't know what it means, but my best friend, Age of Consent Goku, tells me haplogroups are very important, and they mean race is real.
We laugh about this stuff now, but it was legitimately the science of a period. I mean, there are people who were legit phrenologists, which is our favorite topic on this show, because they're like, oh, well, skull shape, obviously, different species. Right. And now it's kind of disturbing to see. I mean, racism has now become far more aesthetic and less sort of, you know, purely like in ideas of blood or biology or whatever. But now, like, that's coming back, which is very disturbing because we have frankly embraced a much more progressive kind of racism than we were working with 100 years ago when we were using calipers on people's skulls.
Right. And I think it's something that actually, like, people, if you ask them, they don't believe it. Like, if you ask somebody who's saying, you know, you shouldn't appropriate the culture of a minority group, if you ask them, are you saying that, like, these racial groups are subspecies of humans? They would say, no, that's racist. But they're basing that argument on that.
Right. And I think what you're saying is, like, if you take this, the logic of cultural appropriation as it's currently used, to a certain point, then what you do get is basically cultural and racial segregation in a certain form. However, like, but then I think, like, the sort of turn to that, or where, you know, someone, you know, might disagree, would say, it hinges on, like, a dominant versus oppressed culture. And then this gets into this idea of privilege.
Yeah.
And, like, and how that plays out, where it's basically about, like, you know, white people are the dominant group and culture in America. So, like, that we sort of, like, you know, pick up things from other races who we're currently being oppressed or disadvantaged by our privilege, et cetera, et cetera. Like that's the problem.
Right.
Not that you know, that, like, cosmopolitanism is going on and people are mixing cultures and ideas.
Right. Well, again, I think that is making the kind of Elvis fallacy. That's saying that that the problem is negative rather than affirmative. That's kind of vague, but it's saying that like that we need to impose limits rather than open up rights, which if you impose limits, those start to apply to everyone. You know, if we say that because you're white and you have this certain set of privileges and that limits what you can do, that opens up a rhetorical space to say that about a lot of other types of people.
Yeah, you know? I think Adolf Reed said something, I think this is his phrase, but I'm not sure, but the problem with the privilege rhetoric is that you end up with, you can end up with the conclusion of just equally distributed misery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is not, well, like we want people to be better, we want everyone
like
to have the
privileges. It's like one of those M.C. Escher drawings where like there's like a thing and then a thing inside a thing and then like it's infinitely those things.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you can always find another level, another vector on which to delineate who has the right to do what, you know?
And like the most obvious use of the widespread immiseration is the idea of like how the police treat people.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like if just everybody were treated as badly by the cops as they treat black people, then that would be a kind of equality. Or like,
yeah,
that
you
would
did
be
see
preferable.
A lot of like Twitter stuff, yeah. During like, you know, the sort of wave of awareness about police violence that happened a bit ago, where people were like, you know, this is what happened to me, and they didn't hassle me, and it's like, yeah, that's good. We want everyone to not be hassled by the police, like. Like
when people talk about how like, God, they didn't call this white guy terrorism. It's like, then if everyone were applied.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't stand that. As someone who like has been misidentified as a potential terrorist at airports before.
Sorry.
Like, don't do that. You know, don't say that we should call some guy a terrorist, you know, when he's not.
Yeah, it's been politically a very volatile category, too, that's been used to like literally go after it. I mean, it's used to justify going after like Arabs, Muslims, and just to a lesser degree, just activists. Like terrorist is a very politically volatile word that
applied to Nelson Mandela, among other people.
I'm in favor of it if it leads to everybody who gets arrested getting Burger King, because it's pretty good. I mean, come on, the flame broiled. It does make a difference.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, I
like their
something...
fries better too. Not everybody.
I agree.
Agrees with
actually,
me on that.
I like the BK fries.
Whoa!
Get
out of here.
See, I knew this would be a controversy.
That is my God.
How did the crowd like? What did you get? Was there a Q&A section or? How did people react? Like,
it was like largely positive, and we were going into it very much, you know, like because the thing is, like, white yeses are not a hostile crowd, but sometimes it just takes one person, one recently woke person, to be very angry. But I mean, they were incredibly receptive, and I think the questions we got were actually very good and like very cute.
Yeah, I think the questions were often, I mean, almost all of them, to my knowledge, were like, how do I put this into practice in my life, in my personal life, in my politics?
Yeah.
Earnest kids who had their hearts in the right place.
Well, and you know, when they're going back to their campuses to become organizers, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's pretty useless to them to have to like separate up their prospective members of their organizations and, you know, have them check their respective privileges. Like, RL is an organizer, and, you know, I think one of his fundamental points was,
him, like, what,
that's not useful.
How do you, how often do you think privilege politics or issues of cultural appropriation help you organize workers? And he was like, I only encounter it when someone is fresh out of college and I have to break them of it. And he's like, so it's really kind of a bother for me.
He brought up this experience that I think a lot of people of color actually have who participate in political activism that I've certainly had, which is that you're at a meeting and someone gets up and says, guys, everyone here is white and there's no people of color here. And I think that's a real problem for our movement. And like, I'm always sitting there as a person of color thinking, get the fuck out of here. Cause I mean, it's always a white person making this statement, you know? Anyway, I mean, it's basically a practice of guilt, and guilt is a personal practice. It's not a political practice.
I think it's not just guilt either. It's about representing like how woke you are. And in some ways it's a little accusatory. It's like, I'm not one of those men. I'm not one of those white people. I'm better than them. And it reads to me a lot of times like jockeying for an advantage. And I think, you know, going back to like the terrorist example, like what people tend to do, or the police example, is to correct things by being more punitive rather than doing sort of the work of liberation, not mm-hmm. to be too grandiose, because one, it's more fun to be punitive, and two, it's just way easier. Rather than
yeah, that
you
was
know,
what I was
going to
say. How
people.
Fucking easy it is! Like calling yeah. something cultural appropriation takes absolutely no brain power, risks nothing of you, and just calls attention to you as somebody who has the brilliance to point out cultural appropriation.
Yeah,
it
I
just
mean,
builds your personal brand.
I don't know if this is a thing that like white activists do for like the performance before POC. Or whatever, but like I know there's definitely something that like feminists call like performative allyship, but I just call like cruising for poon. And it's just like so it's just so clear when they're like, you know, that guy he has real problems with women. I'm like, first of all, why the fuck are you talking to me about this? Like, why did you pull me aside to have this conversation with me? And it can be very transparent, I think, when people are sort of trying to get an advantage out of their wokeness.
But like for, you know, particularly, you know, college students or people fresh out of college, like, you know, we've made fun of it on this show a lot, but like the concept of, you know, wokeness or like how mm-hmm. it's deployed, yeah. you know, on social media and then also in people's like personal lives. I mean, is the instinct isn't terrible, right? Like, but where does it go wrong? And like, I guess what would be like the practical advice you would give to someone who's like, you know, I have someone who they're just a little too proud of how woke they are.
Well, you can kind of tell
the difference. Their politics have like,
right?
yeah. you know, gone in a less productive way down yeah. to sort of just, let's be honest, bullshit.
This was a question that someone sent me at my, at Your Sorry Ass at my column.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, one of the things is like, well, do you think they're doing it to be a dick, or do you think they're doing it because they think they're supposed to be doing it because there's like a distinct difference between those mm-hmm. kind of woke people? And I think honestly, and maybe this is just my optimism, but the majority of like, you know, people that we kind of laugh at for being like silly woke, you know, they really are trying their best. I think most of them aren't like horrible Twitter personalities like trying to get a book deal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's just people don't come up with any sort of class consciousness or material understanding of the world. And like I've seen so many people complaining about cultural appropriation in these sort of broad terms. And if you like drill down, what they're really mad about is the process of cultural commodification. Like that's what they're actually upset by. But they don't know what that is. They don't know that commodification is a process. They don't have the language for it. They do have the language to point out cultural appropriation because it's in the air.
Because you know, Marxism has been purged from the universities, but I digress.
Well, I mean, the rule of thumb, I think, is just find where the injustice is. Locate what someone is being deprived of. Look at what someone is being prohibited of doing rather than looking at what someone is doing out of enjoyment or out of, you know, just a natural inclination, you know?
Well, the great thing about art and culture is that it's like not finite. Like one, you know, like she's not good, but Iggy Azalea does not occur at the deficit of another rapper. Like it's literally, she's not creating less space. She's just sucking very loudly and in public.
Right.
Well, that's what I don't get when people, the assumption there of like, oh, Iggy Azalea is taking someone's place. But she sucks, which means the people who are listening to her have shitty taste. So are you saying that,
also, I mean, there's
that
an
kind
entire
of that the person who would fill their spot would suck too, regardless?
Yeah, there's an entire Whoa. Music industry built around like, you know, creating these human beings in a lab somewhere, running them through like a creepy set of focus groups. And, you know, scientifically creating pop stars. It doesn't have anything to do with...
There's five Scandinavian, middle-aged Scandinavian guys write every one of these songs.
Oh, yeah.
The ones... all the songs that are examples of awful cultural appropriation and all of the amazing liberatory anthems that make Beyoncé the new Sojourner Truth are written by the same cabal
same
of middle-aged Swedes.
It's those same fucking Swedes.
Sorry. Sorry, I was dumping out. Anyway, just want to circle back to the Iggy Iggy Azalea discussion. Who remembers when Azalea Banks was like, Igloo Australia, get your white ass out of here. And
yeah,
then
her insults are like tanky insults.
She sounded like Molly. She was like, these petty bouge fash.
What are you talking about? There's, who doesn't love the well-known and famous igloos of Australia?
Yeah. But anyway, so it was great. And all the woke people were like, yes, drag her. All the people who were like, both of my parents are Reinhard Heydrich, actually. And Cecil Rhodes, like the whitest people alive who care about this shit for some reason. And then, like, the next day, Azalea Banks was like, Bill Cosby's innocent because it's impossible to rape a white woman. Mexican people are trash.
About Mexicans.
Jacob, he invented Mexican people as a joke to make the worst people. And just want to clarify again that Bill Cosby is innocent. But even if he did do those things, they're not bad. And then all the woke people were like, oh man, I'm so conflicted here.
You ask me your questions about politics, about business, about real estate flipping, about life, about sex, about divorce. This is the Ask Sean Whalen Show.
My friends, the most valuable commodity that you have, do you know what it is? Do you know what the most valuable commodity is that you have? It's your time. It's your time. See, I just had a guy on Facebook say, hey, man, I want to pick your brain, whatever, whatever. I said, cool. Here's what my daily consulting rate is. Oh, dude, that's ridiculous. What, you charge? What did it? If you called a lawyer right now and said, hey, can I pick your brain? What's they going to tell you? Sure, I have an hourly rate, or I have an introductory cost. If you call a doctor and say, I want to pick your brain, what do they tell you? Sure, come on in, and we'll chat, and then I'll send you the bill for my time. And so when I tell people that my time has value and that I charge for my time, well, you're an asshole. You're just a dude from the internet. You're whatever, whatever. Why should I pay you for your time? Because I value my time. Because my time has value. I produce results with my time. And if you want it, I'm happy to give it to people that are willing to invest in it. Because most people, guess what? Want to know what most people are not willing to do? They're not even willing to invest in themselves, let alone your time. People don't value their time. People just fuck around and do whatever they want to do, and yet they get mad when I say my time has value. My friends, I'd have you consider for a second that if you want to make more money, if you want to be more successful, if you want more connection, understand that your time has value, and as soon as you recognize your time as valuable, you stop wasting it on people that want to waste your time. You invest it wisely, because guess what? I don't get my time back, and so I'm not going to waste it on things that don't serve my purpose, things that don't get me where I want to be. So understand, my friends, your time has value. The question is, do you value your time? Have an amazing day. God bless America.
I want to I want to ask you about this piece you wrote for Jacobin back in January called Safety Pins and Swastikas. And
just to shout it out, though, I wrote it for Viewpoint magazine.
Oh, sorry.
Jacobin reposted it, but go ahead.
Okay. Originally in Viewpoint, reposted in Jacobin. But it's basically about, like, you talk about how the alt-right and, like, Richard Spencer and a lot of this shit that is burbling up right now is kind of, like, existing in or reacting to the sort of framework of liberal identity politics. And I wanted to get into that because a lot of people got mad at you for it. Like, it sounds provocative on the surface,
right,
but it's actually, I think, a pretty simple thing, like, to
so it's also just literally historically provable if you look at his intellectual history.
I was really naive because, like, I was writing this thing and I did not think people were going to end up sending me the hate mail that they did, which was mostly from, like, centrist liberals and neo-Nazis who were
again
in
they
great
don't think
agreement
they have anything in common
in attacking this. But
you heard it here first. You should have just called centrist liberals the same as Nazis.
That's what happened is that, like, the interpretation seemed to be that, like, if I talk about one thing and then I talk about another thing later in history, I'm saying that the first thing caused the second thing, which is, like, a crazy way to think about history. You know, that, like, if you associate every sequence of events as being cause and effect, which was not the point. The point was there has been a resurgence of extreme right ideas in a particular mold that borrows from the current prevailing left-wing rhetoric. And you see, I kind of started to write this when I was watching interviews of Richard Spencer after Mother Jones called him Dapper. He did a lot of interviews and nobody got a good interview out of him. It was like, you should be nailing this fucking guy to the wall. And instead, he is dodging you at every turn.
I felt a lot of the same way after that, like in that spate of articles about him where he's interviewed by, like, I guess, ostensibly liberal outlets like Vice or Mother Jones or like even like the Washington Post or whatever. Right. It really seemed to me like the people interviewing him were really not prepared to interview him at all. Like they couldn't nail him down. I'm sorry, he came across as smarter than they were.
Yeah, which is unfortunate,
a terrible
because he's
fucking
not
thing.
Smart.
Why? Because he had a very good liberal arts education.
Yeah.
But Shuja, though, like one of the things you brought up was actually his education. Literally, he does know that language. He does refer to himself
as
an identitarian.
He refers to himself as an identitarian. He calls his outlook identity politics for white people. He says that what he wants to bring about his utopia is an ethno-state, which he says is a safe space for white people. That's all like campus activist vocabulary, and he's doing it on purpose because it's hard to react if you accept those terms. You know, the way to nail this fucker to the wall is to attack his false premises, which are based on the spurious biological theory of race. And the left's forgotten about doing that. That's the kind of the problem I was trying to diagnose in that article.
Here's my, you know, bait and hook for Mr. Spencer. Mr. Spencer, you call the white race the people of the sun, but in point of fact, sir, melanin is what is caused by the sun, and the whites do not have it. We are the people of the not sun. We're the snow, the cold people, snow apes, if you will.
Yeah, I'll take the opposite of what you're saying. If he's going to win by aping this identitarian language, what we need to do is fight him on his territory, and we all need to learn about phrenology and racial science, compile a detailed analysis of his skull size and his haplotype, and buy your logic him.
Or, you know, we could just punch him in the head.
We could always just do that.
Yeah. I mean, speaking about not having the vocabulary, watching everybody freak out about that article because there was an assumption that you were blaming identity politics people for creating Nazis. I mean, it's almost as though people have never heard of the dialect.
I mean, I knew as soon as that came out, I was like, oh, he's brave. And I don't think you saw it coming.
I had no idea that I was being brave. I'm not brave. That was an accident. But the responses were things like, this guy just said that, neo-Nazis is the same thing as Black Lives Matter. It's like, where? No, I didn't. Anywhere. Actually, like the kind of prescriptive part of the article where I talk about how to construct a left that opposes this bullshit is the types of things that you see in Black Lives Matter allying with Fight for 15, making that program that is based on the rights of marginalized people into a universal ethic.
I just want to read actually quickly from this article. You write towards the end, this is who are we? This is the question that Richard Spencer has put front and center in the National Policy Institute propaganda. Who are we? The alt-right has an answer, one that is consistent with the long history of imperialism and white supremacy. As their adoption of the language of identity politics shows, the right takes comfort when the left's answer merely inverts the one generated by this history. It allows the right to draw the battle lines, marking the territory of their white national fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long history of dealing with this question in radical movements, in confronting the question of nationalism, which was dealt with in anti-colonial movements, which was dealt with in the Black Liberation Movement in America. A lot of the most astute tendencies in these movements rejected nationalism. You know, the Black Panther Party, for example, really had no time for the idea of saying, well, actually, we're the superior race. You know, that was not what they saw as a viable way of fighting racism. They saw the viable way of fighting racism as being fighting capitalism, which was a system of exploitation. Sorry, I actually forgot what the passage said.
Well, no, you follow it up by saying, if they were confronted, the right, if they were confronted by a unified we, a subject that refused to recognize the borders, divisions, and hierarchies that are regulated by the logic of identity, the alt-right would be left with nowhere to plant its flag. White nationalists would find themselves in the worst possible position for a nation at war, being unable to identify the enemy.
Yeah. So there's an important point earlier in the first passage you read that this way of looking at race, this way of looking at identity, comes from white supremacist imperialist systems. It's not, I never claimed it was invented by left liberal activists. That's why it's so easily picked up by the right. And that's why I think the left needs to avoid it. And the point at the end that I'm getting to about being unable to recognize the enemy is saying that if you can't figure out a way to divide us, you can't fight us on your terms, is most literal extension. It's like in the movie Bullworth, where Bullworth is on TV and he's advocating for a program of biological racial deconstruction. And the host says, "What does that mean?" And he says, "Everybody's just got to keep fucking everybody else till we're all the same color." That's what I advocate.
We finally got into something I'm an expert on, the movie Bullworth.
All right.
But like, okay, so if the antidote to this is a broad-based sort of coalition of like working class politics and a movement based around that and material the material concerns of the vast majority of people in this country. Like how do you feel that that's like playing out now with a lot of these, like the other thing I think a lot of people got mad about was this folk, or not to you personally, but like in these conversations, is the focus on the quote white working class and like, reaching out to Trump supporters. And like now we're reading articles about people who are sincerely Trump supporters. And I'm beginning to question whether any of them should be reached out to at all.
I don't know. I mean, when you talk about like this, the white working class as a category, I don't really want to accept those terms. It's another kind of premise that I'd rather not have to deal with. The thing is, though, about Trump voters, that it's almost a moot point because you have a vast majority of people who didn't think it was necessary to vote at all.
Mm-hmm.
Or who couldn't vote.
Yeah, and who didn't actually endorse Trump but did not vote for Hillary Clinton. And the Democratic Party needs to give a shit about trying to win them over.
I have a question. So, maybe we were talking about YDS earlier. There's younger people who do, I guess, listen to this show. And if they're listening to this, the message is clear that separatist impulses of the alt-right and of, their forebears, it's not a good idea to mirror that in any way or to pick up on that strain of thought and simply invert it, like you said. Some people may hear what we've said so far and just think, like, they may hear this as a very liberal prescription of being colorblind and being like, no, everything's universal. Everyone should just treat each other on the content of their character and blah, 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 which is, I'm sure is not exactly what you mean either. So, for people who are trying to find their way through this admittedly pretty annoying, forest of ideological stuff, how do you differentiate what we're talking about here from the, Jonathan Chait style colorblind ideology?
Yeah, so I would say there's a distinction between the premise that comes from like a certain tendency in the Enlightenment, probably, to argue that like basically everyone should be a white male, and that like the universal is the white male, and that everyone else can be absorbed into that. There's a difference between that and believing in like a mass of people that is constituted by infinite difference, because difference is infinite. Ultimately we all have traits that are unique to us that can't be categorized into groups, some of which can, some of which can't. So the difference is always going to be there, and the difference needs to be what we come together around.
I think the idea of difference becoming politically arbitrary, being like
the philosopher Lambeth Yu says that politics should be indifferent to difference, that the difference should be there, but it should not be foundational to the political ethic.
They're socially and culturally and looking around, haircuts and whatnot.
But
politically,
the issue there then I think is that people would point out that you have certain groups in America, specifically African Americans, for one, who have a distinctly disadvantaged position that would require a specific remedy to sort of make up or attempt to make up for, you know, the vast chasm that's opened up in quality of life over, you know, the last 100 years or so. And
right, but say, I don't think reparations falls outside of that, like outside of this prescription. Like something like reparations actually just makes sense as a, you know, as an idea of bringing people back up to a standard with which we, you know, we would like to have for absolutely everyone. I mean, that's the difference between, like, you know, like sort of equality and, you know, whatever, like egalitarian concepts, like equality meaning like treating everyone the same and having it all balance out, versus like kind of egalitarian politics, which means providing the resources for everyone to have the same floor.
I mean, if you have a standard of saying that we want equality for everyone, then when that the equal rights are deprived to anyone, it's an affront to us collectively, you know. And that's why it's really important to take note of the way that particular groups are repressed, like African Americans in a lot of ways, police brutality, disproportionate levels of poverty. That needs to be corrected because of our firm dedication to egalitarianism.
And that's what makes the objection so frustrating, because the actual identity politics that a lot of liberals try to defend is on the policy side and on the platform side completely vacuous. I mean, for one thing, you have the fact that they're arguing well, you know, we don't want to abandon these people for some grubby white working class. Meanwhile, the Clinton campaign, which is trying to defend itself in a rearguard action as having been sort of the champions of identities, saw a decline in turnout and in percentage of the vote.
I mean, yeah, that's the crazy fucking thing, is that we have this false dichotomy that it's like you have the Bernie bros who are just class over everything. And then the Clinton people, which are supposed to be the most stalwart defenders of identity politics. But if you look at what they actually prescribed, it's like, wait, what? They seem to think that identity politics is like tweeting about Beyonce or tweeting gifs of black women or having a concert where fucking Katy Perry's there. There's no actual practice of identity politics at all. It's just all cultural signifiers.
Yeah, well, the Clinton record on programs that have disproportionately benefited poor people, which are, you know, disproportionately people of color, disproportionately black, and depending on your area, Hispanic people. I mean, it's absolutely terrible. If they were good on identity politics, they would have had like a, you know, at least some nod to decarceration. You know, something, well, at least some nod to welfare.
Did anyone see the Jennifer Palmieri thing?
Yeah.
2 weeks ago?
People don't want a $15 minimum wage. It's all about identity. I think it was something like that. Am I right?
Yeah.
And the thing is that she didn't elaborate. She did not say it's about X, Y, or Z. She just said identity as just like a placeholder. As Forget about these material concerns. Identity as like just a thing to basically, I mean, it couldn't have been more clear, to ward off material claims,
right?
But not actually propose anything at all.
Boy, they just love to lose.
You know, in a way, I wonder if liberals would be satisfied if, like, the demographic of poor people was just racially evenly distributed at the same rate as the general population.
They would certainly be happy if the demographic of rich people were evenly distributed.
Yeah, right. But there's a mirror image to that, too, right?
They would love that.
Let's diversify the poor.
Yeah, well, I mean, you see this all the time. How come there aren't more women billionaires? Who gives a shit? How come there are billionaires?
Yeah, right. How come there are billionaires? That's a much better question. Before we wrap this conversation up, Suja, I want to thank you for talking to us. But before we let you go, I do want to bring this up. You went to college with Virgil?
That's true. And I actually have a story about an elevator ride I took with Virgil.
Let's do it, baby.
Which one was
now's
that? Was
time.
That the Otis?
We were on, it was at the, one of the, what was that dorm called that like upperclassmen lived in?
I don't know.
All right, whatever. It was one of the dorms. There were a bunch of floors. We were on the bottom one. We were trash. We were going up to the top. And as we passed each floor, Virgil hit the button of the floor we just passed. And then we got up
like
to the top. We got up to the top floor and got out, and some other people got in. And then we're just like, What? Because they were going down to the bottom floor. And they had to stop at everyone.
That was
that's one of my cherished so much memories.
Better. That was back. So much better than I could have imagined.
That was back when I was young and rebellious and had nothing but disrespect for elevators before I joined the elevator review community.
You're an elevator terrorist.
Shuja, thanks so much for talking to us.
I had a blast. Thanks, guys.
All right. Till next time, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Cheers, everybody.
See ya.
Bye.
Man, I don't give a fuck about a motherfucking pole. I'ma pull up with that stick and hit your motherfucking dough. Man, I don't give a fuck about a motherfucking pole. I'ma pull up with that stick and hit your motherfucking dough. Don't give a fuck, poppin' bottles in the club. Tryna fuck a Atlanta, baby, let her lick the pussy up. Turn your bitch into a dyke, finna need a baptize. Move for the liquor, finna dive in the ride. Bitch, I don't care, finna fuck a bitch with no protection. I be ignorant, pray to God, I'ma die with my nine on my side. Motherfuck, cop, bustin' like a pork, better hide. Put my dick in the mouth, call that shit a mandible. Cigarettes in my lungs, till I let the pistol go. Look into my eyes, tell me what you wanna do. Before I call you in the street with the rest of your crew. I did this, you know this, the mark on my cheek. Where the bullet grazed and I almost took my life. Forgot what day feels like, I only live at night. Like a bat, not a rat, never die when you at home.
I can't see, walk, talk, then straight, hoe breaking in there from the energy I generate.
You know, the biggest reason we think charter schools are so important is because of opportunity. And the opportunity these disadvantaged children get to be a part of something bigger. In some of the selected schools we operate, we select one child every year who will be sacrificed to the yellow...
Oh, it snuck up on me. Oh, it's going to be bad.
In some of the... Oh, fuck. I'm going to corpse. In some of the select schools we operate, we select one child every...
fuck.
Okay. Who will be sacrificed...
I think I need someone else to do it.
All right, want me to do it?
Let me give it one more go. Who will be sacrificed to the Yellow King, thus widening the portal.
Okay, okay. I'm trying to do it.